I just want to say today is October 26, 2018, and this is Karen Brewster, and I'm here with Kathleen Mike Dalton at her lovely home in Fairbanks, Alaska, and we're also joined by her daughter, Libby Dalton, who will be in and out helping us. So, may I call you Mike?
Yes.
Thank you, Mike, for taking some time today. How about to get us started? Can you tell me when you were born and where?
I was born September 10th, 1925, in Flagstaff, Arizona. And I lived at an Indian reservation agency named Loup, L-E-U-P. There might be an E on the end of that, but that's, I think it's been abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
But those are my first memories.
And what did your parents do that you were on an Indian reservation?
Well, my father worked for BIA as kind of maintenance man and construction on the site, upkeep of the dormitories. That's when all the children were brought into the agency and educated and made to learn
trade.
Learn to recite the Lord's Prayer.
Oh, okay.
I remember, as just a little kid, maybe 4 or 5 years old, standing outside of their big red sandstone building where they went for lunch. Before they could eat, they had to stand up, salute the flag, and say the Lord's Prayer. I remember that in unison. I went home and talked to my mother about it. And she said, well, they're just talking to God, something like that, mm-hmm. Whatever. But now that would be horrific mortal sin by the government.
Well, unless you were in a religious school.
Unless you were in Navajo and were there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, did you have brothers and sisters?
I had one brother and two sisters. And after we lived in Loup, we moved to Tuba City. So my first 10 years were on Navajo reservations. Loup's Navajo Reservation. Tuba City is designated now as the Navajo Nation, that area.
Mm-hmm. And so did you go to school at a BIA school?
No. The policy then was to segregate. It wasn't because they were Navajos and smelled bad. It was because of diphtheria, whooping cough, measles, any communicable disease. They just didn't want BIA people to get sick. So they had a hospital there, and I know some of the little Indian kids died.
Mm-hmm.
Polio. I got polio there. Oh. It was just rampant in it. When they left the agency they went to white man's school and lived in a bed. When they went home, they lived on the dirt floor of the hogan with a Navajo rug for cover.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a difficult life.
Yeah.
But that was their way of living. That was their culture.
And what was the household you grew up in? What was that like?
It's a normal built house. Even had an indoor toilet.
Wow.
In Tuba City, we lived in a redstone canyon out of Tuba City. Well, there goes Boone. He came and got the dog.
Oh, okay.
We lived in this redstone canyon, about 2 miles from Tuba City itself. We go down the plateau, the mesa, and down a trail, and over to my house,
wow,
which is adobe. We had several trails because Navajos herded sheep, and the sheep created trails, and we used to use the sheep trails,
mm-hmm,
going up and down the canyon.
And so was your father also doing maintenance kind of work in Tuba City?
Mm-hmm, same thing.
Same thing for BIA.
In about 1936, I think, we moved to Tucson. He quit working for the government. We moved to Tucson. My first 10 years, we were living on a Navajo reservation.
Okay.
So that's my only memories.
Okay. And then what about your education? You went to college?
Homeschool.
You were homeschooled then?
Mm-hmm. And then we got to Tuba City. There were enough white children that they opened a school. And I was in the third grade then.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big deal, go to school with a real desk.
Instead of at home.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And then where did you graduate high school?
Tucson. Tucson High, 1943.
And then you went to college?
I attended the University of Arizona for 2 years, well, 2.5 years. I went part-time a couple years.
And
then I moved up to Flagstaff, Arizona State, graduated there in 1950. Or 49, I guess.
And what was your degree in?
I don't not remember.
Journalism?
It was partly English, and I studied some Spanish, and I took a lot of engineering courses.
Oh. Okay. So how did you end up in Alaska?
Well, I wanted to come up here, so I came. There was one friend of mine I'd gone to Catholic school with in Tucson, had moved up here with her husband in the Army. And we kind of kept in touch. She had moved to Fairbanks, or the Army had moved to Fairbanks. And then World War II, my father was up here.
Oh.
He was up here at he served World War I in France. He was in the ditches over there in the mud. Oh. And then he came up here as a civilian worker, contractor. He was at Shimya. By the way, if you ever want to collect Coca-Cola bottles in 1942, go to Shimya and dig in the sand. There's hundreds of them there.
Oh, they just left them there.
No, it's a military place. So you'll charge with theft if you take a bottle. I went out there a couple of times with Senator Stevens. I worked for him later. And he'd been told early on, don't let anybody take a Coca-Cola bottle. You'll end up in a federal court someplace.
Now it's an artifact.
World War II for the soldiers.
Yeah, they just throw them out. Tossed them aside.
You could just dig it to sand any place and come up with a 1942 Coca-Cola bottle. Mm.
So what year did you come to Alaska?
1949.
So your father had already gone back to Arizona, or he was here?
Yeah, he went back to Arizona.
After the war.
He'd been up here, went to the Aleutians.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Rosie was up here, so she says, you want, because I told her I wanted to go to Alaska too. She says, well, come on up and stay with me till you get situated. So I did.
And she was here in Fairbanks.
Hmm?
She was here in Fairbanks. Rosie
She was a dog musher. Rosemary Lisonsky.
And what was it about Alaska that you wanted to come up here?
Oh, I just wanted to get out of Arizona and the heat and the sun. For one, I wanted to go someplace where I could find a job.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Rosie's invitation was there, so I thought, well, this is where I'm going to go. So I went.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do to find a job?
Not much. first night I was there, I took the steamship up to Seward and the train to Fairbanks. We arrived about 9 o'clock at night. I didn't have a hotel room or anything. So they took me to the Nordale Hotel, and I slept on Eva McGowan's couch.
Uh-huh.
First night. Next day I called Rosie and talked to her, and she suggested I talk to a couple other people. She said, well, if you're looking for a job, Arctic Contractors down the road is hiring. I didn't know who they were, but they were the civilian contractor for the Naval Petroleum Reserve. For the Navy.
Mm-hmm. For doing oil exploration on the North Slope?
Yes. And they had gone in there in 1945 and started exploring. My husband was an engineer, graduated with Earl Beislein in 1937 from agriculture and mining, focusing on mining. You know, he didn't get to be a gardener, except he planted these those spruce trees and that spruce tree.
Which are now huge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But in 1949, when you came and went to Arctic Contractors to look for a job, you hadn't met Jim yet, had Mm-mm. you?
No. But several people said, well, go to Arctic Contractors. Because I could type. Having typing skills in Fairbanks in 1949 was a good skill.
Okay.
And Arctic Contractors was hiring. So I went down there and walked in and took the first door to the left, told them I was looking for the personnel person. What do you need her for? Well, I'm looking for a job. What can you do? Oh, I can type. Oh, come on in. So I went in, the engineers interviewed me before I got down the hallway, and I got hired. Never did get interviewed by the personnel person. And I had taken a lot of engineering courses,
so
I fit right in.
Do you remember the names of those engineers?
The chief engineer was Ted Matthews. And he migrated between the oil field and Fairbanks. Then another one, the second in line, was Drex Spaulding. Next in line was Ben Atkinson.
I know that name.
Mm-hmm.
We have a power plant named for him.
I know.
Okay.
He has a son who lives in Wasilla. Maybe you've talked to him. I have never met him.
Okay.
Except when he was a baby.
So what kind of things were you typing up for them? Engineering reports?
Yes. Well, the engineers are really good when they at printing and making maps and contours and all that stuff. And they have their own language in some cases. Sometimes their narrative includes algebraic formula. You know, so you have to be able to interpret that. So I would type or retype what they had written because they were lousy at grammar. And I was really good at grammar.
Yeah.
I went to Catholic school, see, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th. Well, part of the 9th. I got kicked out of school.
Oh.
In the 9th grade.
What did you do that got you kicked out of school?
I beat the crap out of one of the biggest boys there.
Good for you.
Well, they were bullies.
Yeah.
And we went to St. Peter and Paul school, and the playground was gravel. There was one place, maybe two times as big as that rug, mm-hmm. with a cement floor, 6 or 8 posts, and palm leaves. That was so we could get out of the sun.
Oh, right. So it was like 8 by 10 feet?
Hmm?
8 by 10 feet, something like that?
A little bigger than that.
Okay.
I'd say it was about 25 feet by 15, something like
okay.
that. But it had that shade in it, mm-hmm. so we poor little urchins could get out of the sun. And I think there was a water fountain there, too, that helped us survive.
Mm-hmm.
And at break time, at recess or noon break, the girls had their own little veranda over here, and their own basketball basket, or whatever it is.
Basketball hoop?
In this corner with a cement, a little bit of a cement playground. play area or bouncing area. Mm-hmm. Didn't bounce too well on gravel.
No.
And the boys were way over the other side. And so this one day the boys got Jimmy Brady. He was my age, of course. He was a chubby Jimmy Brady. He didn't look like an athlete, but they had assigned him to go over there and we'd captured their ball because they'd been teasing us, throwing gravel at us. So they came over and started abusing us. So I got elected to go get their ball next time it came. So we got their ball, and we kicked it way off the playground. And so then we owned the ball then. We had our own, but we just decided we were going to play their game. So after we kicked it out and rolled down the street, they assigned Jimmy Brady to go over there and show us who was boss. So he came over and started picking on me. And so I responded, punched back. And he ran for this veranda area, the large one. Mm-hmm. And I followed him. Just got underneath. I tackled him. Actually tackled him. And I was sitting on him and had him by the ears. I was pounding his head on the cement. I was. And here the outdoor door flew open and comes this very heavy, fat nun. Can't remember her name. We call her Fatty. I don't know what her name was. She says, Kathleen, a young lady does not do that. Sitting there banging his head on the cement. I said, I know, sister. I said, what's going on? Oh, well, they stole our ball. Well, you have your ball. And he said, no, they stole our ball, which was the truth. So she made me go find the boy's ball, give it back to him, and say, now apologize to him. She examined the back of his head to see if he had a concussion. And finally she took both of us in, sat us down in the superior's office. Poor young ladies just don't do that, Kathleen.
Wagging her finger at you.
I said, well, I spilled out my story, and he spilled out his story, so it kind of balanced out. So I got kicked out of school.
Oh.
Unladylike behavior.
So you went to a public school then for the rest of high school?
No, I went home. My parents decided they were going to get me back in school because they didn't want me to go to public school. So they made an appointment. We all marched back into the sister superior's office. They made a deal of some kind. I don't know who it was. They probably extracted some money from them, donation to the school. Well, we paid tuition.
Yeah.
But they probably extracted another $200 or $300. Anyway, I was reinstated in school in ninth grade. And I had a bicycle that I bought for $15, I think it was. A couple of years before that, I'd earned some money and bought a bicycle. We were over in Chandler, Arizona then. And I remember painting it blue and sanding it down and painting it. I paid for the whole thing myself. And so I had normally ridden that school, a basket full of stuff. So when I got expelled, I'd leave the house in the morning with my bicycle and my books and my homework and whatever else I had to carry. Loaded up the bicycle, took off. I got down the block about 1.5 blocks, and I took off down an alley and went down the next street. And I didn't go to school. And so one block from my house to the left was a family named Jones. And Mrs. Jones learned to whistle for her children. Like you do, you stand out and whistle for a dog. She'd stand out on her front porch and whistle for her children. So I thought, well, I just stopped by and said, will you teach me how to whistle? So she did, and I'd go to school, walk on my bike all the way, learning to whistle. You know, but I got to be a good, really good at whistling, especially when they thought it was a boy doing it. I could get lost in a crowd because they didn't think girls could do that. Well, I learned how to whistle through my teeth real loud and walked my bike to school every day. My folks thought I was going to school. And they get an absent report from the school that I wasn't attending. So that ruse ended. They finally got it out of me what I was doing. I said, I want to go to that school. Blah, blah, blah. And, well, where are you going? I'm not going any place. How come you're so late for school? And at University of Arizona has had a polo field that is now all grown up around it with houses. And I'd get over close to it, and then I'd just sit there and watch the horses, watch the practice. And finally, before school hour was out, I'd go to school. Show up 1 minute before class changed. So then they thought they better put me in public school. So I finished out in public school, which was good because I liked that. Mm-hmm. Didn't have all those restrictions. If I beat up a boy, then it was just my, you know, I took the consequences of it.
So did you beat up any other boys in public school?
No. The boys saw me beating up Jimmy Brady.
And they were scared of you after that.
They didn't bother me after that.
So you said you had earned money to buy this bicycle. So when you were a kid or a teenager, did you have jobs?
No, we had incidental jobs. The neighbors would ask us to help them clean up their yard, things like that. Or haul something to somebody else's garbage can.
So just little things here and there, pocket mm-hmm. change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So back in Alaska, you work with Arctic Contractors.
Mm-hmm.
You were typing up their reports.
Well, usually they'd type them, but I'd go through them and correct the grammar first. And so that had to be retyped, unless you're using and marking up a carbon copy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would look at if the report was in chapters or subchapters, I'd go through one by one and redo it and condense it down to what they meant to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I understood it pretty well because I'd taken quite a few engineering courses.
Yeah, it sounds like it was the perfect combination.
Mm-hmm. If they had looked for a secretary who knew how to type, understood engineering terms, and could print mm-hmm. and do engineering printing, I could do that.
Yeah.
And I understood what a contour was and the readings on the contour and why it was this way and why the next one was another way. And I could read the maps
mm-hmm.
and double-check the coordinates.
And these were reports that they were writing up about what they'd found in their exploration?
What they did on up north in the petroleum reserve.
And they were reports they sent to the Navy?
Yes.
Okay.
They, when they brought the early drill rigs in, they had to design the substructure of the foundation, because up then there was nothing but tundra mm-hmm. frozen in the winter with snow. And they'd say, well, we started at this coordinate and we went this way 900 feet and then we went that way 600 feet and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we put the actual very detailed location of the foundation of the rig, and they designed the rigs themselves. And then they also designed the roads. They put that on the contours.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to interpret what they said in their reports 2 north, 16 east, whatever, have to do that. You have to go on the map, locate that, and pencil in the transportation route, things like that.
Yeah, long before word processing and computers and GPS, and I can't imagine having to, one correction, you have to retype the whole page.
Yeah, then we got into, I don't know what the early mimeography, got into that.
Yeah.
Go back in and correct that. Not easily.
No, none of it was easy.
None of it was easy. It was kind of messy.
And so is that how you met Jim Dalton?
Mm-hmm. He was an engineer.
Oh, I forgot to ask you, what was your maiden name?
Fitzpatrick,
okay. So Jim was an engineer,
mm-hmm.
working for Arctic Contractors?
Mm-hmm. Degree was in mining. But at that time, in 1937, every engineer took the same engineering courses. They all had to learn what the other learned. It was all pretty much civil engineering.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember when you first met him?
Mm-hmm. He came in the office one day, and so I asked him if he was an engineer, because I had some standards. And he said, yes, I'm an engineer. And I said, do you work here? And he says, well, yes, but I spend my time at Barrow. And well, that might be the one I want to get to know. So sort of that was my thinking, I think.
So what year did you get married?
The next year.
Oh, 1950?
1950. At Barrow.
At Barrow, oh, okay. So you followed him up there.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about the kind of work he was doing up there and where?
Yeah, I just described it, the engineering work.
Mm-hmm.
And he was assistant superintendent, so he had more responsibilities.
So he was the assistant superintendent for Arctic Contractors.
Assistant, yeah.
And they were based at the Naval Arctic Research Lab. It was the Arctic Research Lab.
Well, no. But at the time, it was Naval Petroleum Reserve Number 4.
Right. But the facilities in Barrow where you were based, where he was based, was the Arctic Research Lab.
Well, it is now, right? Yeah.
Right. It wasn't yet, you're right.
Well, they had a lab there.
Yeah.
It had scientists up there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only base that scientists could use for a home base from Western Canada border to Point Hope or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Umiat being used yet?
Well, the oil I have from Umiat, I can't get to come over here.
Oh, you have that oil sample.
Yeah.
Right.
I think there's a date on there. I was down there in 1951-52.
Okay.
So they started about the same time as base camp.
Mm-hmm.
It was 160 miles as a crow flies from Barrow. The same situation. Down there and took a couple huge, big consoles. I think there are a couple of them still at the lab up there.
Those big Quonset huts?
Big Quonset huts. And for they need them for shops.
Right.
For all their equipment.
Yeah, in Barrow, that what we now call NARL, the
mm-hmm.
Naval Arctic Research Lab part of Barrow, is still mostly all Quonset huts.
Mm-hmm.
And those were built by Arctic Contractors?
They were hauled in there by Arctic Contractors from Navy ships. All Navy, World War II surplus stuff. Mm-hmm. And they come up once a year with a ship lift, bring food and supplies and equipment. And those are all, and the runway at first was World War II metal matting in a set gravel.
That Marston matting. What they call the Marston matting?
I never heard of Marston.
Oh, yeah. I've heard it called Marston matting.
Could be.
I think for Muktuk Marston.
Yeah.
And out in the Aleutians, they used it.
Well, they had to have something
stable
to land on. Unless there was extraordinarily good gravel, sand and gravel area.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a waste of bedrock there.
Yeah. There's a little bit of permafrost in between.
Yeah. It was a challenge, real
yes.
challenge.
So
yeah, I guess by the time Marston was there, they were putting some of it down.
Yeah. Maybe it's named after somebody else, but I've heard it called Marston Matting.
No, that would be World War II.
Yeah. So when you got there, the Navy Seabees were already gone.
They're gone.
Yeah.
My husband joined the Seabees in 1953. Or 43, was it?
I think 46? Is that what,
47? No, he went up there in 46.
Jim went up there in 46?
1946.
Okay. With the Seabees?
No.
No, Arctic Doctrine.
He had tried to get in the Seabees. They organized, I think, in 1953. And these guys like Jim and Earl lived here. In the wintertime, they'd go to school and get a degree. In the summertime, they'd work in mining or construction.
Mm-hmm.
And he had done that for several years here, so he had experience in structure built, structures, structural engineering, land engineering, permafrost engineering. And he and Earl and people like that couldn't do that in the wintertime up here, but they did in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim and some of the other locals decided, well, let's join the Seabees. They had heard that the Seabees were being formed,
mm-hmm.
and their first assignment in Alaska was at Barrow. They said, shoot, we've done everything they're going to do. Let's go up and get it. So they turned him down.
Oh.
Seabees turned him down. Sent him to Dutch Harbor.
Okay.
It had been bombed in June of 42. And they went there to rebuild the runway and hangars and troop buildings.
Troop quarters?
Quarters, yeah.
And what, he was there then in 42 or 43?
No. 43. He joined in 43, and his first assignment was at Dutch Harbor.
So he joined the Navy?
He joined the Navy. He joined the Seabees. They're the equivalent of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah. They're sort of the construction.
My voice sounds pretty bad today.
Well, you could have a little bit of water, might help.
No.
The Navy Seabees. They landed and did all the construction and first things
they
at
went
bases.
To work. They took over from the Seabees.
Yeah. So he was in the Seabees at Dutch Harbor.
His first assignment he was in service for three years.
Okay.
And when his 3 year enlistment was up, they turned him loose and he went back up to Fairbanks,
right.
Went and talked to Arctic Contractors. He hardly was like that.
Okay.
Because he had all that experience.
Yeah.
And he reasoned that he had transportation experience, permafrost experience, general Alaska construction experience, that he would be a first choice in him. Because of that, because that's what they were pioneering a lot of that stuff up north.
Yeah.
And a lot of the exercises that the oil companies went through in 67, 68, 69, they'd all been done before by the Seabees.
Yeah.
So they had a lot of that experience to draw on. They'd get the engineering reports. So.
So when he was in Barrow starting, you said 46?
No, he stayed in after Dutch Harbor, where they rebuilt the runway and the mm-hmm. naval facilities. They sent him to Dutch Harbor, or Pearl Harbor,
okay.
To do the same thing. Seabees were in there. They were all, they were formed in 1953. That's when they were officially formed. And
so he went to Pearl Harbor just at the end of the war?
After his 1.5 years or so at Dutch Harbor, he was sent down to Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
Reassigned to Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
And in 1946, when his three-year term ended, he chose to get out of the Seabees because he knew he could get a job back at Fairbanks.
Right.
So he hightailed it back to Fairbanks, went immediately up north, put him to work the same day.
Wow. And so in 46, he went up to Barrow, and the Arctic Contractors was in charge of the
Arctic Contractors. Contractors entered the scene about the same year.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a civilian contractor that had all the capabilities and personnel that the Seabees had, or more.
Yeah.
More, really. So somebody like Jim, who had experience in Alaska construction, permafrost.
Transportation.
You know, you're getting a bush plane, you're sent 200 miles over here to build a runway. You have to have some ingenuity to pick the right spot and put it. So they were very qualified.
Mm-hmm. And
they were glad to get people like Jim.
Yeah, I would think so. And they also, am I correct that Arctic Contractors was kind of running that camp at Barrow?
They took over from the Seabees.
Right, so they were kind of in charge of the logistics and
they were put in complete charge.
Right.
They just walked in one day and took the Navy man's pen and pencil and drafting table, and he left, and they moved in.
And so just like Jim was, you said he was superintendent or assistant superintendent?
What?
Jim became assistant superintendent?
In about 60, 59, I guess. Because he was not that when I got up there. They moved him up after we were there.
Okay. So tell me about what it was like when you got there. Do you remember when you got off that airplane in Barrow?
Oh, yeah. We flew up there. Arctic Contractors had a airline they contracted with for transportation. And we rode up in a C-46 in bucket seats. There were just seats along the side of the airplane. And then there was a big crack around the back. Cargo door was about that wide.
Like 3 inches wide?
A couple inches apart.
That would be cold.
Yeah, it was cold. If you wanted to get out of Barrow, it was a good ride.
Yeah, what month did you go up?
August. Yeah, didn't have much choice or no other way to get out of there.
Right.
You see, hitched a ride with the Navy back to San Diego the next year.
Right.
Next summer. I don't know anybody who did that, but I suspect there were some. Got aboard the ships.
So you flew up there and you landed on the runway out by the camp out there?
The Madden. Marston Madding.
Right.
That's a good name for it.
I'll have to double check my facts.
Yeah, that would, it sounds like him.
I don't want to give you the wrong information, but I know the runway you're talking about out there. It parallels the ocean right on the gravel bar, sandbar.
I haven't landed on it for a while.
They don't use it anymore. You know, there's a football field out there now. The high school football team is out there.
Yeah, there was some well-meaning rich widow someplace decided they needed some grass.
Right.
She didn't know she was donating to the richest corporation in Alaska.
Yep, she was from Florida, I think. So, what did you think when you got off the plane?
I thought, well, I'm at Barrow, that's where I wanted to go. This is different. That little shack over there was the airport terminal. And the matting, I hadn't seen matting in the gravel.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, that's really ingenious thing. It was World War II developed. Mm-hmm. All that stuff came up from World War II.
Yeah.
South Pacific, a lot of that stuff.
So were you still working for Arctic Contractors when you went up mm-hmm. there?
Yep.
And so did you work there for them?
No, they wouldn't let women work. They would in the Arctic Research Lab, but they would not for Arctic Contractors until they closed up and had to inventory, and they were desperate for somebody could help them type up inventory. So the inventory that I left at the university was partially typed by me. Hmm. Big fat, you know, big fat thing, not like that.
Yeah, folder.
It was the inventory. Everything that was left at Barrow when the Navy pulled it out.
Mm-hmm.
How many screws and bolts and grooves and pumps. And...
But, I didn't think they really allowed women up there.
They didn't. That finally, when Jim was made assistant superintendent, they allowed the supervisory class. It was a class. It was based on class up mm-hmm. there, stature. Except from people like Ned, you know, he wasn't anything, but he could go do anything he wanted.
That was Ned Nusinginya.
Had free rein, you know. He was the only one up there that they gave a weasel to.
Oh. He had his own. He could drive his own weasel.
He had his own weasel, because he ended up to be, besides the interpreter, an expediter from base camp. Run out to airport, run to big hangar one or two or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And into town. Did he drive the manhole into town?
No.
Oh, we should explain what a weasel is for people who don't know. They might think we're talking about a little animal.
What weasel?
They're,
I guess, a little like a squirrel. I don't know.
No, the weasels that we're talking about were those tracked vehicles.
Oh, the weasel tracked vehicle.
Yeah.
World War II vehicle. They had other vehicles up there, but they were huge, big trucks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the weasel was... kind of like an all-terrain vehicle that we have today that seated one driver and one and about five people, six if you could cram them in.
Mm-hmm.
It was tracked so it could travel on gravel.
Right.
If you drove a car or pickup or a truck on the beach or the runway, you'd get stuck
mm-hmm.
in the gravel.
And did it go over the tundra also?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Same, they wouldn't get stuck.
Or they wouldn't sink or leave
yeah.
big scars.
Right. So, because Jim was assistant superintendent, is why you could go up and live there?
Live there, that's why I could live there. There were seven women. Also, the head of the plumbing line superintendent had his wife up there, a few like that. I think the most women we ever had up there was nine.
Hmm.
But two of those were, you know, overnighters.
Oh, they weren't.
About seven.
Do you remember the names of those seven women or their...
Some of them. mm-hmm.
Who were they?
Marcella Lawson. Alice King. Alice May King, M-A-E.
Okay.
Or Lila, not Alice. Lila, L-I-L-O.
Lila May King.
Lila May King.
From South Florida. Was she from Florida originally?
Well, she and her sister were born in Cuba. Then they moved to Florida, and then they got way up the Good Pasture River somehow or other. I don't know how they went from Cuba to up Good Pasture, but that, they went up there and...
They were Southerners, though. I remember that.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Good.
Lila May. So Marcella, Lila May.
Lila May King. Her husband is in charge of radio.
Okay.
He had a radio contract from Base Camp Barrow to Umiat, to any drill rigs that are out there, to any mobile camps on the cat trains. Or to other places that they'd gone out and furnished with equipment and fuel and food for 8 or 9 months. You know, they did that for the USGS and themselves. Mm-hmm. They had to go out and establish sites in the winter that they're going to drill in the summer. So they had to have a summer menu and a winter menu. And for the summer, they had to take so many Marston mats out on the tundra so they could get a small airplane in, because they couldn't land any place in the summer.
No.
All about 15 feet of grass and slush, 15 inches.
Okay, so we've got Marcella Lawson, Lila Mae King. Mm-hmm. Other women and families you remember?
There's Gladys Fravel, F-R-A-V-E-L. Okay. There was a woman named Cunningham, but I don't know, I forget her first name.
Okay.
I know she had a boxer dog. She would put off going out to a whale camp or some unusual event happening just so she could make sure she got home, that her dog got fed on time. I mean, it was, you had all kinds of people.
Yeah.
And they came from everywhere.
Yeah.
Lila Mae King and her sister, the sister never went up there, but they had were born in Cuba, got into Florida, part of their life, early life, and then came into Florida and eventually to Alaska.
And then Marcella Lawson, what did her husband do?
He was a superintendent too, later. Well, during Naval Petroleum, he was an assistant superintendent.
Okay. And where were they? Where was she from?
She was from Wisconsin.
Okay.
He was a cat skinner from Fairbanks.
Okay. And then Gladys Fravel?
She's from some place where they grow peculiar women. She was, you know, a little flighty. Wasn't very sound in her judgment.
Uh-huh. And what did her husband do?
He was a camp runner. He was in charge of a lot of the vehicles. And made certain that the crew for the airport got to the airport when the planes needed them.
Okay.
Or the bush planes, that made sure, stuff like that. Kind of a super expediter.
Okay. And then Mrs. Cunningham, what did her husband do?
He worked in the office. He was a pencil pusher.
Okay. Anyone else you remember, the women? Maybe they'll come up as we keep talking. Maybe.
That's about all I can remember.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about Ned Nusinginye. He worked with Jim as his interpreter?
Mm-hmm. The only people up there they could hire were Eskimos. A lot of them didn't speak English or limited. But Ed was a real bright man. He picked up on stuff real fast. He could speak some English, a lot of English.
And he'd been a mail carrier. I wonder if that's how he learned.
I think he could read and write. He could read and write.
Yeah.
So he had some early education somewhere. Presbyterians were first up there.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Assembly of God squeezed in, kind of took over.
And Ned became a deacon for Assembly of God?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At Kaktovik.
Oh, in Kaktovik.
That was after RE Contractors.
Okay.
Jim asked him one day, Ned, how did you get from working in the oil field to being a preacher? He says, Jim, the Lord just put his arms around me and he wouldn't let me go. That's what he said.
Hmm.
The Lord put his arms around me and wouldn't let me go.
Hmm.
Did he end up in Kaktovik?
Mm-hmm. He moved out of Barrow and went to Kaktovik. Well, they had a church in Barrow, and then they had needed a preacher over in Kaktovik, so he considered himself a preacher, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And when I lived in Barrow, Faye, his wife, was an elder, and she was living in Barrow, so mm-hmm. at least she came back. I don't know the story of him.
I don't know if she knew her or not.
I don't.
She might have.
Yeah. I didn't know him.
Fenton would know.
Yes, yes. So you said, yeah, you were living there with the Arctic Contractors camp, but you couldn't work. And no other women were allowed up there.
Yeah, right. Most women were not allowed. Only the heads of the departments.
Yeah, they weren't allowing women scientists up there.
Yeah, they were. They were the only women allowed up there.
Oh, they were?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of women scientists up there.
Like who? Do you remember? Do you remember any of them?
Some were USGS. The two couples who were supervisors about the last 6 years were from the Academy in San Francisco.
Okay. California Academy of Sciences?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they were allowed their wives up there.
Yeah, I was thinking at some point, I don't know if I can remember the years, but I heard that the only way women could go there was if they were married in like mm-hmm. with like your situation, or married if their husband was a scientist and the wife came up as yeah. his quote unquote research assistant. Mm-hmm. But that women
pretty much it.
Women scientists by themselves didn't
once
go
in
there.
A while.
And maybe that was your time period, maybe that was changing.
It eventually is. There's still one woman at Pioneer Home who was allowed to go up there.
Is that Florence Weber?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she had to be on a field trip.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't go up to visit or anything.
No.
She and Florence...
Collins.
Came to Alaska together, and they worked as geologists for the project because they were geologists.
Yeah.
And they worked on interpreting drilling samples. They had their lab in Fairbanks.
Right. Yeah, it was my understanding that they couldn't go do work up in Barrow in the early years.
Right.
Because they were women.
I think they might have changed that later when Max Brewer came
yeah.
in.
Yeah.
Or John Schindler, I'm not sure who changed that policy.
Yeah.
But the Navy always had a commander up there in mm-hmm. uniform.
Mm.
And he was allowed to bring his wife up, so... I can't remember their names.
But when you were there, he was there. There was the naval commander and his wife.
She was there, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know who it was. I can't remember. We were not... The Navy guy and his wife played bridge. And some of the women played bridge. I didn't play bridge. So I didn't get to know some of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what did you do for socializing?
We'd play canasta. Not much else to do but play cards.
Knit. You knitted.
Knitted.
And Lila May showed me how to knit. So I started knitting.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you knit?
What did you knit? Libby asks.
Oh, I knitted argyle socks. Now, finally, I came to the conclusion it was useless to spend the time on argyle socks because you had to change your yarns many times. And I had a cat and was always playing with my yarn. So I got past that, got into making sweaters.
Mm. So did you make plain socks instead of the argyle pattern? Did you just do single-color socks?
I made a lot of plain socks, but right now I haven't made a pair of socks in more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. I could do it again if I looked at the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to do that.
When you said that they hired a lot of the Inupiaq people, was there much socializing between the natives and non-natives?
Those of us who lived up there were not allowed to go over to the village. The only way you could get there is walk or get access to a weasel. And I was so far down the pecking order that I had to do the walking part.
And it's about 3 miles, I think.
About 3 miles.
I think so, yeah. So how often did you go into town?
Maybe once a week. Not very often. I didn't know anybody there at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what would be the incentive to go to town? Why would you want to go to town?
I wanted to go to town and see if anybody had anything, any crafts for sale. Here, I've got some barrel stuff over
there.
Yeah,
I see that. An usik and the Osceola oil lamp and jade adze, all kinds of neat
jade
things.
Adze.
Yeah.
That came from the mouth of the Colville. And the jade adze came from Wainwright.
Okay.
Area.
Okay.
They were both gifts to my husband.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to write out an affidavit on that, because when I'm dead, you know, they'll have somebody from that deplorable university come over there.
So
praise it and say, well, it's worth $15. Look, yeah. It's so dirty.
No, they wouldn't say that. So
the heck they wouldn't. They know me.
Can you talk about Jim working with and hiring some of the Eskimo people?
When he got up there, some of them had already been hired.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to know them. That's where we got to know Ned.
Mm-hmm.
And later, when the project was finished, there was one named Sam Tellick, for example, came over and took care of all the space heaters in the residential area. And somebody else would come over, and he was an assistant to the head plumber. And they had others who were assistant to carpenters. And be sent out to do that job, you know, take 2x4s and so many 2x6s and enough nails and hammer and go nail it up where it's supposed to, and they could do it. But at first they didn't know the difference between 2x4 and 2x6 or 2x8 or 2x10. They learned. That was during RD Contractors.
Mm-hmm.
So they learned a lot of skills at that time. And then 3 years after RD Contractors left, the Dune Line started, and Jim was recruited by the
visitor.
Heard a noise.
The doorbell.
He was recruited by the Defense Department to go up there. And they were in a big hurry. It was Cold War, and they were in a big hurry to organize. So, as I said before, he could go. If he needed a cat train put together, he could go to the Mecca Bar,
mm-hmm.
see somebody new and ask him to help him round up some of the guys. They knew what he meant, some of the guys. That meant the crew on a certain cat train.
Mm-hmm.
And that it filtered down so they had really good compatible crews on this cat train and then the next one. Somebody came to the door.
Yeah. So he worked for the Dew Line.
That was the Dew Line. Okay. That was started in 1957.
Okay. So I'm going to keep us on Arctic Contractors mm-hmm. for today, and then we'll move.
Okay.
Next time.
Well, the hiring of the natives happened in the Dew Line.
Right.
It was the first local hire in Alaska.
Okay. Well, Arctic Contractors.
Arctic Contractors pretty much was local hire. They had a conflict with the unions.
Oh.
About 1958.
Mm.
And they raised Cain, said you can't hire those people, they don't belong to our union. And there was a Davis-Bacon project where they had to join the union and pay those wages.
Those Davis-Bacon wages.
That Arctic Contractors paid. They were the best winter jobs up here
mm-hmm.
in Alaska.
Yeah.
At the time.
So how did that union conflict get resolved?
Didn't go too well. They came up and demanded that Jim fire all those people. He said he wouldn't do it. He said, well, they got to be able to do this and this and this and this if you hire them. But under the Davis-Bacon, if they're able to perform the task, they have to hire them. They can't discriminate against them.
Mm-hmm.
So they got a few of them out there to get in a cat and do certain things. They showed that they were capable of running the equipment without tearing it up. And same thing with the plumbers and the electricians. They had to hire them. they took him into the union. That was the first. He forced that issue. And they didn't like it. The unions didn't like it, but the law was the law, and they were working for government now.
Yeah.
Directly.
Well, he must have appreciated the Native.
He knew what they could do. If he called Ned at 3 o'clock in the morning, Ned would be at the door in an hour. Or if he called Sammy Talek, told him that three of the space heaters and the small Quonsets were out. Can you get over here and help us and get them going? Oh, yeah, yeah, Jim. Sure, Jim. Sure, Jim. Oh, yeah, Jim.
So the...
They would do anything for him.
Yeah, so the... Like the head carpenter or head plumber or head electrician, they were non-natives from...
Mostly.
And then everybody underneath were native. Is that kind of how it worked?
No, not most of them, just part of them.
Okay.
They didn't have to go to town to hire an electrician. Because there was somebody in the village who was already capable.
Right.
So they go over and they'd send Ned over to get so-and-so. We need him to come to work. We have to electrify this. So Ned knew what it was about. He'd go over, get him out of bed, take him over, put him to work.
I wondered if those native guys learned some of those skills from the...
Arctic contractors.
Yeah, all of the Arctic contractor guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were skilled.
Did the native people become heads? Like, was there a head?
No.
No.
Except Sammy Talek. Mm-hmm. He's about the only one on the...
Kenny Tuvok, did he become head of...
Who?
Kenneth Tuvok.
Kenny Tuvok.
I don't know if he became head of the equipment operating.
I don't know what he was head of.
I know he did heavy equipment operating, but I don't know... And then he helped scientists a lot. But that was not Arctic Contractors anymore, I don't think. When did Arctic Contractors leave... Barrow.
53.
Okay.
They ended a contract and left.
Okay. Do you remember any of the other Inupiaq people? There's Ned, there's Sam Talek.
Sammy Talek?
Yeah.
Oh, I remember them by sight.
Yeah.
But those are the ones I got to know.
Okay.
And some of them had been out of the village and gone to school at Mount Edgecombe.
Oh, right.
So they had a little advantage over some of the others.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they were living off the land then.
Yeah.
They were taking their...
They had dog teams then.
Their sleds and dogs and heading for the... Brooks Range going caribou hunt. Sometimes they need somebody to come do something. Well, he went, he's in camp. What camp? Well, they'd say what camp it was. Might have been in the Brooks Range.
Mm-hmm.
He had his own schedule. Who's that?
That was Walter.
Who?
One last question and then maybe we'll stop for today. Does that seem
good idea? Good?
Okay. I just want to know where you lived at the camp. You lived in one of the Quonset huts?
Mm-hmm.
And then you started having children up there?
No.
That didn't happen till...
They didn't allow children.
Oh.
I had George when I went back for the dew line.
Oh, okay.
He was just a toddler. The guys loved him.
They didn't allow children. Arctic contractors.
So yeah, if the families, if the women got pregnant, they had to leave and raise their children elsewhere?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
They didn't want to deal with children getting hurt or something. It was enough having women up there for the management.
Yeah.
Because some of them were a little precocious.
The women or the management?
A couple of them. Well, all the guys. There were a couple of women who were there. Kind of experience.
Well, I know certainly in the Navy days there were men going into town and having relationships with Inupiaq women in town, whether they were allowed to or not.
What was that?
That the Navy days, those single Navy men would go into town.
Probably.
And have relationships with the young women. I don't know if that was happening when you were living up there.
They did that, but they had to walk over, walk back, or take a dog sled home.
Mm-hmm.
No taxis. Well, no. Dog sled taxis, I guess.
Well, there was no road then between town and camp. It was just going.
It was a trail.
Trail, yeah.
It was a well-packed trail.
Yeah. So did guys get in trouble for going into town?
No. If they made any trouble, they did. They got fired.
Okay.
Every once in a while, somebody would get fired just to be an example to the other guys in the barracks. Because that was one of the basic rules, stay out of the village.
Mm-hmm. Was there alcohol at the camp?
Mm-hmm. Every Friday, we could go into the little camp store and buy a six-pack of beer.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they didn't have any alcohol. But they bring it in.
Yeah.
But things got out of hand. They knew who did it. They'd maybe put them on the next airplane. Whatever. They just had a rule. If they broke the rule and were blatant about it, they just said, go get your gear or you're leaving.
Well, I knew they did that when the Navy was there because it was a naval military base. But I didn't know if that continued with Arctic Contractors.
Well, there was an unwritten rule that was broken from time to time.
Okay. Well, shall we stop for today then and continue on another day? Okay. Thank you for today.